I think, you know, we've all heard statistics about women being forced out of the workforce. We've also heard of statistics around women starting more businesses than ever. And we have to like really look at that critically. Is that, are the new business starts a function of not having the flexibility because they're having to do multiple hats, right? They're under a lot of pressure with schools closing, especially with childcare not being available. What kind of flexibility is needed to just survive and maintain all those functions?
It's no secret that the coronavirus is affecting all of us as individuals. But the effect it's having on business, especially small business, is unprecedented. We need a game plan, and fast. If we're going to survive this, we need resources and we need each other. We can't do it alone. I'm Jesse Torres, and this is Hack My Business. With my background in economic and workforce development, disaster preparedness, and general business strategy, I know I can help you navigate this scary time in your business and beyond. It's all about resiliency. I'll have the most current solutions and best practices available so we can ensure your business not only survives this crisis, but thrives. We'll also be keeping you informed about the latest resources for small business so that you don't miss a thing. Co-hosting with me will be my colleague, Sid Varakara. We'll have invited experts to help us navigate through the current noisy landscape of resources and programs that are being made available today and who will be able to prepare us for tomorrow. Let's do this together. I'm Jesse Torres, and this is Hack My Business. Hi, and welcome back to Hack My Business. This is Jesse Torres, creator and host of Hack My Business, and it's great to be with you all once again, talking about the amazing and exciting world of entrepreneurship. I'm thrilled today to be joined by a really good friend, Anna Marie Cruz, who has a couple different roles, and we're going to be talking about that, her work and her many different lives and what she does. But I know her best as a Western Regional Manager at ICIC, and also the founder and executive director of an amazing organization called Entrepreneurship. Anna Marie, so good to see you. Thanks for being on Hack My Business.
It's so great to see you as always. And being this far away virtually, I know it's difficult, but it's been great to stay in touch these difficult these last few years and also just be here. I appreciate this opportunity.
Of course. Yeah, it's always good to overcome the chasm through the virtual world, right? Mm-hmm. And although I do miss our happy hours, if I can, you know, be so bold as to say. But yeah, so good to have you on the show. It's so much to talk about as relates to your work around serving under-resourced communities through ICIC, your work, hands-on work, and supporting BIPOC entrepreneurs. But also, I know you have this very interesting part of yourself and work around wellness. And so I definitely want to try to dig into all that in the time we have. So I'm just going to dive right in. And first, really want you to be able to kind of share your career journey. I have to tell you, like, I always thought, like, my LinkedIn profile was the most exciting to look at because of the number of different positions that I've had in my life. But when I saw yours, I'm like, oh, Anna Marie has done some really cool stuff throughout her life. And so take us through your journey, because I think it's really fascinating and all the different things that you've done.
That's so kind, Jesse. I like to describe it as the zigzag of careers. And sometimes
that's what I would say. Yeah, absolutely.
Sometimes the Benjamin Button of careers.
Oh.
Going backwards at times. So at least sure. That's how it feels. But let me take you back to 15 and a half years old when I got my first job as a sandwich artist at Subway. Amazing. I was working for a small business owner. Obviously, Subway's our franchises. And that was actually my first exposure to a small business. And, you know, outside of like informal small businesses that my family, my mom had run over the years. But I started there. So really, you know, started working in my teenage years and loved working. Worked throughout college, paid for, you know, my tuition, whatnot. And my first career was actually in real estate finance. So what drew me to it, though, was my interest in personal finance and investments. And I found this family-owned mortgage company in Huntington Beach and was really interested in learning the investment side of things. But at that time, this was during the height, the real estate market in the early 2000s. And he switched, you know, he pivoted and because of the rise in just activity in real estate, decided to focus solely on the real estate side, which I didn't even know really existed. It was the first time I was exposed to the industry. I loved it. And right out of college, I started my full-time career as an independent contractor, sales salesperson in real estate, primarily on obviously financing. And did that really all the way up to the market crashing just right before it, and had an opportunity to switch careers actually and do some soul searching as I was watching things implode and explode. We actually used to watch this mortgage implode-o-meter to see which organization was going to crash next, like if it was Bear Stearns or whatever it was, Lehman Brothers. It was also the only website that was probably utilized a lot during that time. So it was a weird time, right? We have a
lot
of
movies.
Was
it like a volcano? Describe the implode-o-meter.
Man, the implode-o-meter. Literally, you know, we'd log on every day to see which bank or which lending organization shut down. And we just didn't use the internet as much as we do now. And that was probably one of the most popular sites at the time. It was crazy.
That's amazing.
So I actually switched from being an independent contractor to working at the banks. I was in the banking real estate industry. I worked for JP Morgan and a bank based in Ohio doing wholesale. And at that time, I kind of had a moment of reflection. I was a sociology major in undergrad, and I was really interested in social justice work. And I was seeing kind of the opposite, you know, people foreclosing and these banks taking advantage of them. And I just felt so dirty. So I needed a soul cleanse, if you will. So this is the first major zigzag in my career. I actually switched to nonprofit medical, and I worked for Be the Match. So at that time, it was called the National Marrow Donor Program. And I worked with families who were searching for a donor match, a lot of families who unfortunately didn't make it. And I mean, it was a very difficult in a new sense to me. It was really focused on bringing equity also to accessing donors. And I know, kind of a weird switch, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because there's, you know, not to stop you in your career journey, because it's fascinating. First, a big shout out to you in that your first job was food and people related. I worked Mervyn's, my first job, my first real job. And
you mean open Mervyn's?
Okay. Yeah, exactly. Open. Nobody's going to know that we're talking about. But I always knew that I can never handle both food and people. I can handle people, but not food and people. So I give you a big shout out. But it kind of sounds like there's this thread of trying to help those that are in need, right? You know, both.
In need of sandwiches.
In need of sandwiches, in need of real estate. I mean, the kind of like, I feel like you're on a path here, but keep going.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. What I really appreciated in these different roles was the ability to take my knowledge, take my expertise, and make it accessible. And I think one of the biggest things I enjoyed most about real estate finance is, you know, working with people on the biggest purchases they'll ever make in their lives and really bringing empowerment to that decision, right? So finance to me, personal finance as a whole, was really, I think, it made me feel that joy of being able to take expertise and distilling it so that it's understandable, it's empowering, and it helps people feel like they can take even, you know, the next step after that. So after real estate, you know, how are you going to build wealth, et cetera? So I think during the time I was at the National Marrow Donor Program or Be the Match, I also started to think about, you know, how do I blend these things? How do I blend my quest and my passion for social justice and, you know, economic empowerment business with social impact? And at the time, our CMO, our chief marketing officer, was, great guy. He's actually still a great, you know, a person I still reach out to at times. He went from a traditional marketing background doing, you know, brand management from big companies like Pillsbury, and taking that knowledge to Be the Match to create a brand that was really accessible and really friendly. It made people feel like, you know, donating marrow or stem cells was something that's manageable and doable. So I saw him as a really great example of that combination of taking social impact and business. So I started thinking about going back to school. So I did, went to University of Michigan for an MBA. And at that time, as you may recall, back in the 2008-09, right after the market crash, CSR or corporate social responsibility was still a new term, right? Sure. Now we see it being much more, I think it's just ubiquitous. And really, frankly, I think that time frame really set the stage for where we are. In any case, I went back to school and wanted to pursue social impact, but kind of got stuck. I actually decided, you know, I'm not ready to make an impact in this social impact world without having traditional skills. Let me go back and do brand management and figure out how that works before I take a step into this new path. So I did an internship at a big food company and brand management, and it was not for me. Like, I should have known from the start, like, that was not me. I mean, if I look at my background today, you know, if I look at all the decisions I made, I really have always been entrepreneurial and liked the idea of creating solutions and, again, putting power in people's hands through the use of, you know, business. Anyway, I sold pretty much all my possessions with the exception of what could fit in two suitcases. Wow. And I left right after my MBA, left the country and did this 6-month consulting project in Vietnam working with micro enterprise development. So it was actually a 5-year project with 3 United Nations or UN agencies, the ILO or International Labor Organization, which supports the creation of dignified work and upholding that throughout the world, and then FAO or Food and Agricultural Organization, and then UNESCO, which really preserves a lot of, you know, cultural sites. Sure. All over the world. And it was amazing. I worked with 19 women weavers in the mountainside. I was probably one of 3 people who spoke English in this town of 10,000. So I was both lost and also excited and at times, you know, pretty lonely. So a combination of those different feelings, which ultimately led to my own health and wellness journey, but more on that later.
Yeah.
So to me, I mean, that was really the pivotal point of my career where I decided to pursue economic development. I didn't even know everything that was involved in it. I just knew this was it. Like, if I could support more of the, you know, this kind of work, the more women in particular, more women to have the tools, the resources, the ability to create their own businesses, their own micro businesses, what kind of impact could I make, you know, long term? And there were a couple of moments there too that I asked myself, is this really a sustainable kind of project? I mean, what are we doing here? We're putting money into this town that has never had commercial activity. Now we're introducing entrepreneurship and business and really the activity around money, which they never really did. You know, they basically, this was a weaving community. So they would weave clothing and exchange it with each other. You know, it's an indigenous tribe. It felt at times like I was corrupting.
Yeah. Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
A different type of gentrification kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there were a lot of things that I reflected on, but at the end of the day, 2 key things that I witnessed firsthand. One, I decided, you know what, I'm going to find out what they actually think of this project from their own perspective. So I asked a translator to go through a series of questions. You know, what if this business were to become a success? What would that mean to you? And the majority of these women actually said, you know, it means that I can send off my kids to get their education, or they can go outside of our village, which is 3 hours away from a major town. They could leave this and explore. So much of it was about possibility. And these women who had never ever been outside of their town, had never gone to, you know, had never been outside their village, excuse me, they didn't even know what their kids would see, but the thought of having that possibility was really a sense of hope for them. So that was interesting. And then another instance where I just realized, okay, this is important work. One woman was actually experiencing domestic violence, you know, from her husband. And once she started making some money, it stopped. And he actually, Yeah, I mean, this was within a couple of months of the project. So once he saw that there was, you know, there were results from what she was doing, he stopped abusing her and actually started contributing to taking care of the kids, and especially while she was weaving. And the whole point of the project was to make these woven materials more accessible to other markets. So we worked with a local retailer who would buy from them. So they became part of that supply chain and they were getting paid for their work. You know, they were getting paid fair wages for the textiles and for that amount of time that they were doing this. So I think those two things have really validated for me the importance of this work. And in the big picture, the importance of creating the opportunities for women in particular. Right.
So then how do you take that back? I mean, first of all, what a powerful experience, and how, you know, how terribly sad, you know, for that is the, I guess, the reason why she was able to escape the abuse by showing some type of incredible story. But how you bring that back to the U.S. and how does it inspire you into the career you have now?
Well, again, I didn't really even know that this industry existed. And I think for those of us who think of global, you know, extreme poverty, we know about microfinance. We know about these different tools. I mean, I have a book right here, Banker to the Poor by the founder of Grameen Bank. You know, there's a lot of stuff that we actually have learned here in the U.S. from a lot of countries in that are what we call developing countries, right? Where there's a much bigger income inequality. So I didn't actually know that in the US that there were opportunities for me to contribute to an industry that supports economic empowerment here. So when I first returned to the US, this was in 2013, I found this role and it was just the right combination. So right after Vietnam, I decided to go to the Philippines. And I mentioned there was a health and wellness journey for me. Part of it was reconnecting with my mom and, you know, fixing some of the stuff that I had with her for a long time. So I spent a month with her in the Philippines. And so I also felt reconnected to my home country. So I left the Philippines when I was 9. I didn't really know what was happening at that time. Basically, as a 9-year-old, you know, I was taken from there and told, we're moving, right?
Yeah.
So moved to Southern California, and that was the end of me being in the Philippines. So I think that was really healing for me to be in my home country and to feel connected to what I was abruptly taken from, and also to reconnect with my mom and to understand her own experience and her own struggles and to really see her as this person as opposed to mom. She struggled so much. You know, she lived in poverty. She was one of 11 children. She was born right after World War II to a mother who only received education until she was 14 years old. So those may be more typical in those types of countries. In any case, I came back to the U.S. and found this opportunity at SEPA, Search to Involve Filipino Americans in L.A. And they're part of a collaborative called API Small Business Collaborative, which is comprised of 5 different ethnic community organizations. And there was a role for a business counselor. And it would be supporting immigrant, you know, micro entrepreneurs, a lot of Filipino entrepreneurs, as well as immigrants of different backgrounds and people of color. And it was just perfect for me. I was like, what? This can't be. So I'm here taking the knowledge and the passion that I had from Vietnam and applying it to an organization in LA. And that kind of opened up a whole new world for me here. Started getting
exposed. Feel like sometimes, you know, like that having that kind of zigzag, because I had the same kind of zigzag career path, that it actually does you more favors than negatives, you know, because then you come armed with a certain understanding of the world that many people don't when they go through a very linear path, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, in many ways, like you were meant to be in that spot because of your journey, right? And meant to be successful because of your past food experience, right? You know, understanding customer service, you know, spending time outside the U.S. I always find it so fascinating that even through my own journey that all those little things I learned along the way sure did help when I needed it. Mm-hmm. In a more senior position. I don't know if you feel the same way, but I've always felt that.
I agree. And I think connecting the dots from experiences that you pursued because you wanted to just creates a much more unique destination. So right. that's kind of where I'm finding myself now. And, you know, fast forward to today, I went from a women's business center that API, Small Business Collaborative, is. So it's a federally funded program, much like the SBDC. So it's a women's business center. I went from there doing technical assistance, is the official term for that kind of work or that mm-hmm. industry. And then I moved into lending. So I kind of revisited my first career, right? Small business lending at a CDC. And from there, now at a national organization that provides both technical assistance and connections to capital through a what we call a mini MBA for small business owners. You're right. I think the zigzag, I am not regretful at all. At times it was confusing, right? Or mm-hmm. I felt lost or I felt like, oh my gosh, what am I doing with my life?
But I think, you know, I think there's many more of us than we like to admit, right? And I think people are often kind of embarrassed by that, you know, that like, oh, I had, you know, so many different careers or jobs, right? And but I think there's value to it. There's power in that. I'm really curious, and I got to know you by being in meetings where nobody could mess with you because you had this deep understanding of both cultural competency and finance at the same time. So it's always dangerous being in a room with you because you knew that you weren't the smart. Like I knew I wasn't the smartest person in the room whenever I saw you in there because I was like, oh man, she's going to be able to kind of connect all these different parts together. But I know just because of your work and having seen it up close that you have your understanding of how to engage and work with an under-resourced community is really profound. And I'd love to know, like, of all the things you've seen, all the work you've done, what are like one or two key takeaways when it comes to doing that type of work? Because I think a lot of people stumble and fall, like definitely like cities and governments, like it never kind of comes together often, right? So what has been your key takeaways about launching a successful program in an under-resourced area?
Well, you are so generous and you are so kind. I feel the same about being in the same room with you. I mean, your background and your expertise, and I think your ability to also, I think, be curious is what's most threatening about you.
Curiosity, of course.
Yes, absolutely. Because curiosity opens the door to real learning, right? Not just So I think in building inclusive prosperity and inclusive economic empowerment really starts with that curiosity and with that that openness to learning and co-creating. And, you know, I've had the opportunity to learn about that through ICIC and my role, you know, being exposed to so many markets, especially in the last few years during the pandemic, and understanding the complexities of economic ecosystems and small business ecosystems around the country. And one in particular that I always like to bring up is Hawaii. You know, we have this notion that Hawaii is a paradise, and it truly is for a lot of tourists, right, for us visitors. But Hawaii experienced the greatest shutdowns during the pandemic, 19% of businesses shut down, compared to much lower numbers. It's still high numbers, but much lower in other markets. And I think what that, you know, what that told me is we really have to pay attention and understand it from the ground level. I know that sounds very simple, but even in areas like Hawaii, where we have all these assumptions, we're probably thinking that everyone there is well off, you know, they're able to live in paradise, they have, you know, the beaches so accessible to them, but we're not realizing that gentrification on an island looks very different and actually scary. You know, right. Where do they go from there when they can't afford real estate? Where do they go when the business is shut down because everything that they do is around tourists and tourists are not coming? So, you know, that's one example that's very recent. But other things like, you know, with the work that I did in Vietnam, I think big picture for me, what that translated to in my own passion was how does my personal background, having come from the Philippines, how does that all play out? And so I've been working on this other project, Entrepreneurship, which is a combination of Pinay or Filipina and entrepreneurship. And people will sometimes say, well, what's the importance of building a small business resource organization like Entrepreneurship when Filipinos seem to be well off. You know, they, like, as part of the AAPI community, they're more, they're highly educated. They're, you know, a lot of stereotypes around the medical career and being nurses. They're okay. Well, actually, if we look at, again, inclusive communities and inclusive prosperity, 12 million Filipinos live outside of the Philippines, and many of them are working not just in healthcare, but also as domestic workers, as caregivers, a lot of undocumented people in countries around the world, in the maritime industry. So if we're not paying attention, if we're not curious, if we're not listening, we're not understanding about communities. Right. So your point about cultural competency, how do we bring that into our everyday work in this industry, right? I think that's probably one of the silver linings of the pandemic, is we've known a lot of these challenges, but there's no way to avoid it at this point. There's no way to, you know, turn a blind eye. One other thing I'll say is, when it comes to access around, you know, under-resourced communities, capital is always a major challenge, no matter where we are in the world. And then when you look at women in particular, you know, making sure that women have access to capital, that's, I think, universally true as well, whether I'm in the Philippines or here in the United States. Here in the U.S. and I think in Canada, we hear, you know, anywhere from 2-4% of VC funding goes to women-owned businesses. I think that increased a little bit and then came back down. And so, you know, what does that mean if we're not putting money in women's hands? And what does it mean for families and for communities?
I think you really kind of nailed it on the head. I mean, as far as what makes the work so exciting and so challenging and working with underserved communities, and the desire to go deep into that relationship, knowing that it takes years to form trusting relationships, gain the competency doesn't happen overnight. And too often I see folks really trying to do it too fast, you know, trying to take shortcuts, and it never works out. Even beyond, say, like the language barriers of the community, but really the what drives them, understanding. I love how you mentioned in working in Vietnam, that actually asking the women, you know, is this bringing value to you? Is what I'm doing working, right? And let me know, because if it isn't, then we'll find a different path. I mean, even just that basic element of, is what you're doing really bringing value to the community, or are you just adding to the problem? Mm-hmm. You know, even that alone is like a really great kind of key lesson. You know, we're recording this session about a week and a half before the next kind of big primary election here in California. Everybody's trying to figure out how they can help address disparities now. I think everybody's kind of seeing this opportunity because of pandemic to try to rebuild in a way that is more equitable, right? And I'm sure we're going to get it wrong. I'm sure we're going to get many parts wrong. But how would you advise, you know, how would you advise, say, the next mayor of LA or, you know, the next assembly member who is really interested in seeing what they can do to support community in their district that they know is under-resourced, right? Mm-hmm. How would you advise them to build anew out of this post-pandemic era?
Right. Yes, how are we all emerging from this, right? And what can we do differently to create sustainable systems? From what we have seen, again, you know, these inequities are nothing new. It just so happens that the pandemic magnified them. And one area in particular is around women and childcare and the infrastructure that should be there. I think, you know, we've all heard statistics about women being forced out of the workforce. We've also heard of statistics around women starting more businesses than ever. And we have to, like, really look at that critically. Are the new business starts a function of not having the flexibility because they're having to do multiple hats, right? They're under a lot of pressure with schools closing, especially with childcare not being available. What kind of flexibility is needed to just survive and maintain all those functions? So I think first and foremost, like, really looking at how we are allocating resources to key industries that support women and families, right? And I think reframing that as something that is valuable to society, I think we have missed the mark on this, right? We think that having a family as a burden on society, as opposed to this actually helps us be more productive. It helps us be really competitive. So I think that's first and foremost, looking at that industry and then looking at other industries that are vulnerable. I think this is the first time maybe in our history where we had grants that were allocated to small businesses. And in particular, we saw that with closures, you know, that impacted certain industries more than others, like hospitality, again, you know, looking at tourism. I think this is also a, you know, a bigger discussion on the economy. Like, how is LA diversifying its economy or making sure right. that we're not, you know, too skewed on any one industry? How do right. we ensure that we can pivot more? How can we be more agile? Again, that's a bigger yeah. picture or bigger conversation. And then I think the other piece is around, again, these traditional resources that are always capital. How do you make capital flow in areas that just have not received that attention? So part of my goal with entrepreneurship is actually to build a CDFI. And what is a CDFI, okay. right?
Yeah, what is a CDFI? Tell everybody what a CDFI is.
So CDFI stands for Community Development Financial Institution. And I'll just say kind of a short version of this definition is it's to make sure that banks and financial institutions and actually the government can assist with making capital or money flow into neighborhoods that may not even have a bank in their community, may not have these resources that support wealth creation. So CDFIs are a vehicle, in particular with small businesses, it's a vehicle for those that don't qualify for institutional financing. So usually businesses that require less than $250,000 of funding. But it's not just about the dollar amount. It's about thinking of communities as what do communities have? What kind of safety net or what kind of wealth do they have access to? So if you and I were to start a business, what are our resources? Could we go right. into, you know, our 401k? Could we ask mom and dad and an uncle for an investment? And if we don't have these things, where do we go? So in under-resourced communities, that's what we find, that there aren't these additional safety nets. So how does society, how do our politicians, our leaders actually make that a possibility for them? So how can politicians actually support the creation of more CDFIs in their neighborhoods, right?
When are you going to run for governor? When does that happen? When does that happen?
I'm eligible,
next? is that right? Okay, that's right. I think it's amazing. I mean, it's the first time ever, you know, speaking of things that have been unprecedented, where I've heard in the past couple of weeks people talking about the idea of creating an incubator that starts with, like, let's begin first with the childcare center there. You know, mm-hmm. that is a new thing. I love that you're thinking about how do we even change the mindset around that rise and grind kind of mentality, right? And saying that, no, start family first, right? That you can have a family first approach to entrepreneurship. You know, that alone is radical, you know, radical.
Absolutely.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's crazy time. But I think I feel like this is a moment for you and I and for people like us who've had zigzag careers, who see things in a different way, come from immigrant communities where we have an understanding of how things can be done differently. And we just now have the opportunity to really take direct action to kind of realize that, you know, and I think maybe our listeners probably don't quite know the significance around creating essentially a financial vehicle, you know, that mm-hmm. doesn't exist. I mean, that's a big deal. I mean, you know, that to bring that type of capital to a community that has never had access to it, that is reliant right now upon
predatory
cards. Right. Mm-hmm. Predatory lending, et cetera. I mean, that is a game changer. You know, so I'm so curious about, like, where are you now with entrepreneurship? Are you focusing first on just building cohorts of entrepreneurs? Are you building the financial piece first? Like, where is your time and energy being spent right now?
Mm-hmm. Right now, it is around building cohorts of entrepreneurs. And I think, you know, part of it is strategic. Part of it is, let's have a proof of concept, right? Let's see how, by providing resources, training, education, mentors, all of that stuff that we call technical assistance, that can lead to successful entrepreneurship, that it actually does create established entities that can also create jobs. And then part of it too is, you know, looking ahead at building a funding program. Could these be candidates for that? Could they be, once they're at that proof of concept point, would they be the ones that should be accessing these loan programs? So I think it's those two things. I also, you know, want to say that what we are seeing right now with AAPI-owned businesses, I mean, as we're recording, this is still AAPI Heritage Month, and the increase of anti-AAPI violence is also rocking me, right? Like, how do we create more resources and visibility? So part of entrepreneurship is bringing more visibility to AAPI and Filipino-owned businesses, and to show that there are different dimensions of our communities, you know, that we do, yeah, maybe we are nurses, but we also run businesses and, you know, we have these other pursuits. And I think that helps to make our community feel seen and feel visible, but it also helps other communities see that we contribute in many ways to society.
I think that'll be one of the few, you know, silver linings, I guess, from all this, that sense of community, right? A renewed sense of community, visibility. Right. Activism, you know, I'm seeing that again, you know, or really kind of for the first time. I'm excited to see where your work takes you and how you become an even greater kind of community leader, because I think California is very lucky to have you, because you're championing causes and have been doing it for a very long time. And I feel like you're entering this really unique moment in time where you're going to kind of take into stratospheric kind of elements. You know, I know we're coming, we only have a little bit of time left, so I definitely wanted to touch upon the wellness, because I know that that is also a big part of who you are, and I know that's a big part of entrepreneurship, because, you know, like I said earlier, there is this idea that, okay, entrepreneurship needs to be a certain way. It has to be you alone in the dark, you know, working away, task, toiling yourself, you know, to craft something, and then you don't have a personal life, you know. How are you changing that conversation or changing that image of the entrepreneur?
Well, I follow this account called The Nap Ministry. It's all about taking naps.
Taking naps, really? It's called The Nap Ministry?
Okay, let me back go back. Well, first of all, I do not believe in that crush it culture at all.
Yeah.
I think it's toxic, and I think part of what we're undoing right now is exactly that, right? The sense of hyper productivity, and I don't know, I think just redefining what entrepreneurship really is, that we've actually seen for generations, like you said, you know, coming from immigrant backgrounds, we've seen our parents, our grandparents pursue entrepreneurship, but maybe we don't call it that because it's not Uber or it's not this you know, hyper growth kind of sense of the word. They are still solving problems, they are solving a market need, but they're most likely micro enterprises. So, I mean, I just want to put that out there, that, you know, redefining entrepreneurship and maybe looking at it as having multiple goals as opposed to just hockey stick growth and getting equity and, you know, exiting. I think that's also a great way to pursue entrepreneurship and wealth and redistribute that wealth, but that's not always the case. I think for me, the health and wellness piece is more about aligning ourselves with our values. So first defining our actual values. So while I am doing a lot of things right now, and some people will sort of judge me and say, well, that's too much for one person. At times I agree, but at times it's what motivates me. It's what excites me. So I hate to be so cliche, you know, that term of when you're enjoying what you do, it doesn't feel like work. Not always, you know, I still need a nap, like I said, but
hence the nap ministry. Yeah.
The nap ministry, you know, micro naps here and there. But I think it's more about alignment as opposed to work-life balance. You know, that term to me is really outdated. It's more about finding people who, you know, align with you, finding activities, or again, this sense of synergistic types of relationships within your world, within your whatever you're interacting with.
I know we can keep talking forever, and we often do, but we're approaching time. How can people join you in your journey, keep track of all your different activities, get involved with entrepreneurship? What would you recommend?
Yes, absolutely. Look up Entrepreneurship on all the social medias. So Entrepineyship. And then also I'm on LinkedIn, just my name, Anna Marie Cruz. I would love to connect, especially if you have ideas on how we can make the world better through entrepreneurship.
Anna Marie, you are the best. Thank you for being on Hack My Business. I look forward to seeing you again in person soon, hopefully. Yes. But just really appreciate all the work you're doing to support vulnerable communities and to bring community together here in California and across the country. So thank you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Jesse. Thanks for everything you do and for being an inspiration to me and for this platform.
Thank you.
If you need help and want to be a part of our community and find resources to grow your business, join us at our website at smallbusinessfront.com. We'd love to see you there. Have a great day, and we'll catch you next time on Hack My Business.